Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Miral Sattar. She's the founder of a new website, a new publishing platform called BiblioCrunch, which is BiblioCrunch.com. Hi, Miral. How are you?
Hi, David. How are you? I'm really glad to be here today.
I'm glad to have you on the call. So maybe why don't we just launch right into a discussion about BiblioCrunch? You know, I think I'm assuming most of the people listening won't know what it is, haven't visited it before. So maybe you could talk about what BiblioCrunch does, but also what was the thinking that got you to launch this website?
Okay, well, so I actually am a publishing industry veteran. So I used to work at Time, Time.com, Time Magazine, and for one of my projects, I had set out to create an ebook, like an interactive travel ebook. And when I started working on it, I thought it would be much, much easier than the creation process would be. But it took forever to get all the pieces in place, test it on the different devices, and convert to the following formats. And I thought there has to be an easier way. So what I started doing was playing around with my own system and seeing if there's a way that you could write once, publish anywhere, and then make it work in any format, any e-reader, and kind of make it web-based too. And that's where the idea of BiblioCrunch came about. So it's supposed to be the next generation e-publishing platform that makes it easy for anyone to create and publish an ebook. So anyone can go online if they have a blog, if they have archived content, if they have new content, they can write their chapters online and they can publish their books, and their books will work in any format, any e-reader. And then when I launched the site, we got a little bit of press around it. So we had a bunch of authors sign up, and then the feedback that I had gotten from them was that they want to be able to create their own individual stores where they could actually already put their ebooks on the web that they had already created. So we changed that functionality. So now what you could do is you could create your ebooks in the cloud, or you can kind of create your own ebook shop if you already have your ebooks. So we have two ways for authors to kind of use the system.
In other words, now, this would apply to a publisher, too, I would presume. Because I see you have Going Rouge on the site. So that is a book that was already published in and created in whatever format. You could upload to BiblioCrunch, and it essentially becomes another bookstore for for ebooks that were created in other platforms.
Yes. Yeah.
So does that mean you accept... do you just take an EPUB, basically?
Well, we take an EPUB, we take a MOBI, and we take a PDF. And if you only have one format, we can help you convert it to all the other.
Got it. So in other words, for this to work, for your promise that anything on BiblioCrunch could be read on any device, you've got to have either you're making it on the fly for somebody who's creating on the site, you'll be making the EPUB and the MOBI and the PDF so that whatever a reader needs, they would be able to get from you. Or if I bring you an already existing book, you would want me to upload the MOBI, the EPUB, and the PDF just as I would do to a distributor.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of like creating an Etsy storefront, but for your own digital books. And then the royalty rates are better too.
Got it. So do you see, and now how do you see yourself, or how do you see BiblioCrunch fitting into the kind of existing ecosystem where, you know, I think a lot of readers and maybe authors too are kind of, I don't want to say trained, but they're kind of led to think that each ecosystem of reader is the primary storefront for them to work within. So that, in other words, you know, fairly clearly Amazon and Apple have this and actually Sony for that matter, all of the device makers want you to buy your ebook from their store on their device or from their store onto the reader that you might have on another device. And so in a lot of ways what you're having to do is figure out how to siphon off readers who don't realize that there is a sort of Catholic, this ecumenical way of existing with ebooks?
So we've kind of been thinking about that a lot too. And what we've been doing is, because the main objective for BiblioCrunch is to make it as little, like, writers should be responsible for writing their books, and they shouldn't have to worry about the different systems, the different formats, and once they get their book out, like the platform or the publisher or the agent should be responsible for promoting their ebooks. So what we've done is we've given them a set of tools which kind of lets you create your own SEO-friendly page, create your own book clubs, like the publisher can do it for you. But then what we're also kind of working right now with a bunch of distribution partners, and we're just in the initial stages of talking, is to kind of have an initial feature. So if you publish your ebook on BiblioCrunch, and there'll be like another process at the end which will distribute your ebook to all the different stores. So you can kind of just manage everything in one place. And then it will track your Amazon sales, it'll pull in your iBookstore sales, it'll pull in your Barnes & Noble sales, and that's kind of what we're working on right now. Because right now what we're doing is each person will say, well, I want to submit it to the iBookstore, I want to submit it to the Barnes & Noble store. So right now we're just charging them a fee to do that. But I kind of but we're working on integrating that into the platform too.
Got
So
it.
kind
So
of the
just, because you sort of inevitably think of comparatives, and I want to talk to you about other things, but I still want to, get a clear picture of BiblioCrunch for myself and for people who are listening. Would you compare then what you're doing? Sounds like it's similar to what BookBaby is doing. In other words, a really easy to use front end. Now you're doing some things that are different from them, but from an author's point of view, and BookBaby's done a lot of advertising, they're promoting themselves pretty heavily. Do you see yourself being essentially in competition with BookBaby?
Well, BookBaby provides just the distribution services, right? So you can go online, you can do the conversion, and then but they don't actually have it's a service-oriented website. And BiblioCrunch is more based on a community platform. So it's kind of like we just don't provide the service. We have like 100 designers on the site whose work you can browse through and who you can hire to actually do your cover design for you. We have like 100 editors on the site and copy editors who can actually help you edit your work. They don't just actually just do like the service. They actually work with the editor. So it's kind of playing on like the crowdsource models. Like you want the best editor, you want the best designer, and then they'll actually go and help you work through the different process with you.
So, and do you have like a, as community sites that have resources like that do you have a rating system and kind of points that people can get for doing a good job so that let's say I'm an author, I come on your site, I need an editor, how do I pick somebody?
Well, you can go to our community, you can click on editor, and then you can sort by like the top rated or the most reviewed.
Right. So the more somebody does it and gets reviewed and it, is well thought of, then they're going to rise to the top, essentially. Of course, those guys or those people get more busy too and have less time to do it. Because, I mean, it is interesting about editing and proofreading. All the work that goes into making a book is very linear. It's you're selling your time. So there's only X number of hours in the day. You'll reach a limit. I think the editor who's really good is going to be busy, whatever number of hours they're able to put in. So they can't expand their business beyond the number of hours that they have.
Yeah, but then also that's their day jobs too. Like it's that's how it is for them in real life too. So it's kind of just bringing their offline persona online, and then getting like greater reach. Because there's some really great editors that I know who no one knows that are great editors, but I use them all the time. So helping them, putting them on the platform, kind of helps them create their business too.
So how many people are working on this? Because this is a really big project, and obviously it takes a lot of work. Do you have a staff, or is this mainly, using a set of freelancers to help you do this?
Well, we have a full-time staff of three people, and then we're using freelancers to do a lot of the like the editing and the designing.
Right. And are you bootstrapping, or have you got financing?
Well, just a little bit of disclosure. My husband is a venture capitalist, so we're bootstrapping right now. But the idea is, and it's because we think that we can get to a certain level until we ask for funding. So, and I'm pretty confident that we can get to that level. So when we get to 50,000 or 50,000 people or 50,000 readers, then we'll ask for funding. Because it's easy. Because I've built communities in the past for other companies, and this is actually my second venture. So I have like the marketing strengths to actually market like a good product and grow it. And I know it's easy to get to like 50,000, 100,000, but if you want to get to the millions, then that's when you actually need the venture money. So we're working on creating our pre-value money before we ask for any money.
Well, that's a lot of work, it sounds.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's probably the hardest thing I've ever done.
And are you working at it full time and more, I
Yeah,
presume?
full time and more all the time, every time. Sometimes I have to stop myself at 11 p.m. or 11:30 and say, "Wow, I've been working on this since 7 a.m. I need to take a break right now." Or sometimes on the weekends too, it's like I'm always thinking about different things that you could do for BiblioCrunch. Because I come from the digital magazine side of the business, where we try to create ebooks. So I think I have a different perspective and different ideas than someone who's been in the print publishing industry for so long. There's different ideas that you could do, there's different marketing tricks that you can use, and there's so many fun things that publishers aren't doing or so few are doing right now.
Yeah, no, I think that's been a fair criticism of many publishers that their marketing is not, and especially marketing in the way that the web requires. It's, you know, it, I've, you know, I think we've talked, you and I may have talked about this before, that, marketing isn't about picking up the megaphone and saying, "Here I am, buy my product." It's really about building relationships with people, and that's a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
You have to engage them, not just tell them. Sometimes it's asking rather than telling. But so it, so beyond so is your go initial goal is to have 50,000 member readers. And I mean, you might not want to say how many do you have today, but how far along are you? How, what do you think? How long will it take before you get there?
Well, that's something that I've been closely monitoring. So we have 1,000 members on the site right now, and we haven't spent any time marketing. It's just through like the press that we got, and I'm really excited that a lot of these people are like authors and designers. And every single publisher that I've approached about our marketing strategy to get them onto the platform, no one has said no yet. And which is really exciting because that kind of validates that publishers, big publishers, especially like the Big Six, are looking for ways to get their books out. Because the problem that you always run into is you have these books where they spend like $100,000 on the advance, they spend all this money on marketing, but then they have so many other great books that they don't have the money or the budget to market. So we're kind of working on with them to help them bring those ebooks onto the BiblioCrunch platform.
So,
And
and tell me, so far, what has been the biggest your biggest problem? What's been the hardest thing to overcome so far?
the hardest thing to overcome so far is the bootstrapping and doing it by yourself. Obviously, I'd like to spend $100,000 just on marketing in the next 2 months, but instead, it's kind of taking like a few thousand dollars and figuring out where you want to concentrate your marketing efforts on. So it's just not having the money or the luxury to do what you'd ideally like to do. But then, but the little things that we're doing are definitely working. And then also with publishers and authors, it's not just like you mentioned, it's not just like, oh, here's the product. It's kind of building a relationship with them and like talking to them over a period of few weeks, making them comfortable with the system. Because a lot of authors are not comfortable dealing with digital products. And a lot of publishers are trying to get there, but they're still kind of, they want to test out new things, but then they kind of want the guarantee that the new thing will work too. And in the publishing industry, there's no such guarantees because the industry has changed so much. So it's kind of just working with them and just building the relationship. And it helps that the first question that I always get from a big publisher is like, have you worked in the publishing industry? I'm like, yes, I worked in the publishing industry for 5 years and I've been in the media industry for 11. So I understand the space very well, because I think they get a lot of people who aren't from publishing or who don't understand the issues that publishers have or authors have that try to come in and disrupt the system. So it's just kind of building and establishing those relationships and convincing them that try this new thing or try this new idea.
So that's on the kind of supply side, is, you know, you're talking to authors, you're talking to publishers. Now on the other side, which is the reader side, because obviously, you know, there's a little bit of chicken and egg for anybody doing what you're doing. You have to have content before readers will pay attention to you. So the first stage, you probably have to build, you know, you have to have as much content as you can get. At a certain point, you say, okay, I have enough that I think I can attract readers. I don't know, how many titles do you have on the site now?
We have about 100.
Okay, so and when we're talking, just so for reference, it's early October 2011. Do you have a feeling of how many titles you need before you can then kind of turn your attention to the reader side and say, look, here we are. You know, this is what we've got. We've got interesting books. We want you involved. It's a, you know, we're not just a bookstore. We're a book community. Come join us. And so, you know, when do you decide that you've got enough content to do that?
Well, that's kind of tied into what we're bringing in with the big publishers that we're working in, we're actually just launched a new product, which is in beta. So you can't get to it if you click on the site. You can get to it if like someone from the BiblioCrunch community has invited you. And it's the idea of this thing called a sampler, where you automatically get ebooks delivered to you based on the preferences that you've chosen. So, and then what I'm doing is I'm targeting the various like book clubs and the book blogs to bring their communities onto the system, because my biggest challenge for me as a reader, and I'm an avid reader, I love reading, I read like at least one or two books a week, or I try, it's finding the next good book. So I can, right now I can go online, I can sign on for this thing called a sampler, and I pick the categories that I like, parenting, children, our dystopian fiction, and then what we do with our publishers is that they'll give us samples of some of their new books, and we'll automatically deliver the samples to our readers. And then if the readers like them, they can purchase those ebooks. So the publishers are kind of bringing those books onto our platform that they want their readers to buy, and readers are being able to discover new books, because anyone that I've talked to as a reader or an author is like, well, I have this great book. Like, how do I get people to discover it? And then the sampler is kind of like our solution for that and kind of growing the reader base. So right now we're offering readers like the sampler. If you've got a Kindle, it'll come directly to your device every week. If you have an iPad, it'll come directly. You can kind of open it and, you know, start reading, and then you'll get a free chapter.
That seems like, I think that's a really good idea. I've actually long believed that sampling is the key for online readers, that, or for writers and readers to meet each other. You know, I think that the Amazon Kindle, I thought the killer feature when it first started was that ability to download a first part of the book, because you could, you know, it's better than browsing, you know, in a store. You can try anything. And I think that's something that I think will be effective for you. You know, readers want to check the book out before they put their money on the table.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think a lot of it is about the time issue, that, you know, we live in a time, in a period when people are really busy, they're pressed for time, and you feel this all the time from readers that they are very jealous and protective of their time. So if you, it's really not even the money issue, it's the investment of time that matters most to them, that they don't want to read a book, they don't want to buy a book, find and start reading it and find out they hate it. They kind of want to know that it's going to be good. They don't want to know what it's about, and they, I mean, they don't want to know too much, but they want to, you want to get engaged before you make your decision. So I think that's a really good idea. So, let's talk a little bit then about how you see things, kind of evolving, not just for BiblioCrunch, but this, I think it's fairly clear that the online and digital reading experience is evolving, and that a lot of us, a lot of people are thinking about what's going to happen, how is this going to work, what do readers need, what do writers, how do writers and readers connect. So BiblioCrunch is one, kind of innovative way of creating that connection. But that's, how do you think things are going to move in the next few years? What is the evolution of this whole digital space?
Well, I think if you're a digital-only company, your community is actually going to decide the direction that you move in. And that was already evident in the first launch that we did of BiblioCrunch, is we had all these features built in for authors, and authors told me, "Well, I hate this feature. I don't want to write my books online. I don't want to write my books on the cloud. I just want to be able to upload my book." And then within a week, we were able to change it and create a system for them to do that. So it's kind of letting your readers, your authors, and your community decide the product that they want, because they're actually going to be the ones who dictate the direction that the industry is going to move in. So it's kind of just listening to them. Because earlier this week, Perseus, or I think it was last week or over the weekend, that they made an announcement that they're working with agents to actually self-publish their own books, which I think it's kind of an interesting way of looking at it, or an interesting way of doing business, because the message, like when I read that, the message that I got is, "Hey, you're not good enough to go through one of our editors or our publishers or go through our editing process, but you can use this platform that we have." And I think that is kind of a little bit insulting to the author, because if someone told me, then I would just say, "Well, I could self-publish on my own. Like, I don't need you. I could just go straight to Amazon, to the Barnes and Noble's bookstore or the iBookstore. I don't def if you, my book is not good enough for you to publish, then I don't see why I should use your platform," because those tools kind of already exist. So I think more and more publishers are going to try to do their own publishing platform, but I think they're going to realize that people don't read based on publishers, or they're finally going to accept the fact that people aren't going to read based on publisher loyalty or a certain type. They're going to read based on the content that they like. And the more and more publishers who try to launch their own publishing platform, I think it's just kind of confuse the reader, because if they put in an agreement that, "Oh, you can only publish it on our bookstore," then the reader isn't, or the author isn't going to have a choice except just to go through the mainstream retailers like Amazon or iBookstore or the Barnes and Noble bookstore.
So do you see that that the do you feel that authors are thinking differently about the whole experience of publishing?
Definitely, definitely. I think there's more authors who are self-publishing more and more. I think they want to keep more of their royalties, and I think they want to give up less control of their book. And I think they're actually going to be the ones who dictate the future. And it's going to be more between authors and readers and the community that they create between them, the direction that the industry is going to move in.
So, and do you think that in that sense, do you think that publishers are aware of this concept that, as you move to the online communities, you have to listen to what your communities tell you if you're going to be a successful business. I suspect that that's not inherently easy for a traditional business, but some of them, I suspect, may figure that out. I mean, do you think that they're capable of learning this lesson quickly enough?
Well, I think they're capable of learning the lesson. I do hope they're capable of learning it quickly enough, but we all know that publishers never move fast. They're typically the last to adopt to something. So I was really excited when I heard that Perseus was doing this self-publishing thing. But then also, I thought about it from a reader's point of view, and I thought, or an author's point of view, and I'm like, would I just go directly to them to actually buy a book? I kind of just want all the books available to me that are publisher agnostic. So maybe they'll figure it out. Maybe they
Well,
won't.
yeah, I mean, I think it just to go back to the Perseus thing, I think what they're doing is they're acting as a distributor, and they're kind of doing what, in a way, what you described earlier, and that is, I think public authors don't want to have to mess with a lot of the details. I think a lot of, maybe some writers do and others don't, but I think a lot of writers don't want to have to worry about, how does a Kindle format work versus the EPUB, and and Kindle Fire is going to create a new specification, and who knows what else is coming along. I mean, authors want to write, they don't necessarily want to know technology in the details of how it works, so that what you're doing and what Percy is doing in that way are similar. You're acting as a platform, solving problems for writers and readers, kind of behind the scenes, so that they can meet each other around the book. In that way, I think Perseus and the other kind of traditional ebook distributors are in fact doing what you're describing. Because they make the files available, they deal with the heavy lifting of technology, and the authors don't have to worry about that. I guess the real question is, I'd say the listening on the customer side is really hard for publishers in many ways, because they're disconnected from the reader. Even if you're any publisher today, most of your ebooks, if not all of them, are going to go through retail outlets that basically mimic the way that the book business and other industries have always been built. The retail store has the customer, the publisher customer is the store. So that's going to make it harder for them to do what you're suggesting is what they is going to be something that they need to do, and that is listen to readers.
Yeah.
Because you're a retailer essentially, and a kind of and a wholesaler all rolled up into one. But if we think about Book BiblioCrunch from a structural perspective in the book business, in a lot of ways you're a retailer.
Partially, yes.
Yeah, I mean, because your retailers, consumers will buy books from you. And so you have a direct relationship with those readers that a publisher cannot have. So, I mean, I
And then
think.
we're pretty fast in responding to our audience, so it can take us like maximum 2 weeks to change something, whereas and that's the case with any startup, is you can move faster, much quickly, you can listen to your community and your readers and kind of figure out what they want. And I think what And big publishers, they have the same problem that every big company does, is they will think they will spend all this time investing all these features that they think the author or the reader will want. But I think what you always need to do, and I've found this in any product that I've launched, is do a prototype and then let the community or let your audience dictate the product and the direction that it's going to go in, because that's what's ultimately going to make it the best product.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense, and that's an advantage you have when you're launching something new, is to listen to what people tell you about what you've done. Then you have to act quickly to change it to meet the needs of those people. Otherwise, you're sort of stuck. And that I think that is a I think that's a big difference in the way things are working today than they have worked in the past, with website development, for example. When it's become much easier to change websites on the fly and add features and take things away that didn't work. So in that context, when you look around, who do you think of as, and it doesn't have to be in the book business, it could be anywhere online, who do you look at as kind of models of real virtue in that sense? People, entities or companies that listen really well, make changes to meet their customers' needs. Who do you think of as the model?
Well, I think startups in general, I'm heavily involved in the startup community. There, are you familiar with the Pulse Reader?
I don't think so.
Oh, so the Pulse Reader is a nice, it's mostly for reading articles. It's a really fancy RSS reader. And what it does is you can customize, it's kind of like Flipboard, but you set your own feeds. And it's iPad friendly, and it also works on your iPhone device. And they have an incredible, incredible product. I actually don't go to individual news sites anymore. I kind of just set them up all on my Pulse Reader. In the morning when I'll get up, I'll just scan through it. It's based on my preferences. And they actually have a beta testers list. And before they actually launch a product, they get feedback from their community who of active testers that they know. And I'm part of that community. And I'll get to do my feedback or I'll get to do my enhancements. And they're really good at making sure that it is the best product possible, which I really like about them. And I think more companies should follow the Pulse model.
That's a no. I think that sounds brilliant. Actually, it sounds like a really cool tool for people who are trying to keep track of lots of information online. I think, overall, that is one of the key challenges for everybody is just that there's so much information, we don't know how to keep track of it all. So that sounds like a good tool, but also I like the idea of, having a group of beta testers. I think that's really smart. Is that something you're going to replicate, have beta
Yeah,
testers?
we have our core group of like 30 people, which we're kind of hoping to grow out into like 1,000. But right now it's just like 30 people, like an author, an editor, a small publisher who are kind of like give us feedback. But what we do is a lot of our community does give us feedback. So sometimes people ask for a feature that is specific just to them and not representative of everybody. So then we'll kind of ask everyone, or we'll do surveys on what is the most helpful feature for you, or what would you like to see enhanced, and then they'll let you know. Because I think it's important to make the community feel like they're part of the growing product, because the product just isn't the person who started or the publisher. It's the product belongs to everybody. And if everyone kind of feels like it belongs to them, then they'll take more interest in developing the product. And I think Pulse does that really well. Like I always feel like whenever they do a new release, I'm like, oh yeah, I helped add this feature in, or and it makes me feel more connected to them and more loyal, which I think they do incredibly well.
Right. No, that's a very, I think that's a powerful thing is you get the users essentially to become owners, spiritually and psychologically, they're owners of the product. So, but does that mean that you have obligations to them too? Because if they don't feel like you're responding to them, then after a while, people, if you're really fully invested in something, you can be also more easily offended, let's say. I guess that's a risk you just have to run.
Yeah. I mean, there's egos, there's author egos, there's editor egos. They all exist, and it's just kind of managing them. And like, there's the right way to say something, and then there's the wrong way to say something. So you can say, no, that doesn't make sense at all. I would never implement that feature. Or you could say, oh, this sounds interesting. Let's do a poll about it and see what everyone else thinks.
Right, no,
And
that's
then,
fair. Right, and it turns out maybe, that one person, it's just a that it it's just a they're an outlier. It's not going to work. It's you can't please everyone, obviously. But no, it seems like I mean, it's I'm really impressed with what you've done, and it seems
Thank
like
you.
you have a lot of there's a lot of potential. I think that the biggest challenge for anybody in a startup is just getting enough people to participate. It's a tough road because there's You have to get people to change their habits who may have already become habituated to going to, I go to Amazon every day, or I go to Barnes and Noble, or whatever it is that people say they do. There is a certain, on the web, noticeably, the larger entities get the bulk of the traffic. So you have to find a way of siphoning. You don't need everybody. You just need enough of the readership out there. There's a lot of people, so
Yeah.
you just have to find enough of them to participate to make it work. But I respect the difficulty of doing that. So I hope maybe we'll check in again a year from now, and you'll have reached that 100,000 number of readers mark, and be well on your way to big success.
Definitely.
So, listen, thanks for talking to me today about not only about BiblioCrunch, but about, your ideas. And I wish you a lot of luck, Meryl.
Thank you, David. Thanks so much. And thank you so much for having me on the show.
Sure. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I've been talking to Meryl Sattar, who's the founder and main person behind BiblioCrunch.com. Thanks so much.